Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's start by getting up to speed on all that's happened on North Korea. First, there was President Trump's bellicose statement yesterday.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
And to remind you, Trump's remarks came in response to reports that North Korea had created a warhead small enough to fit on top of one of its intercontinental ballistic missiles. Nevertheless, despite Donald Trump's remarks, North Korea did indeed make a threat, saying it is considering a missile strike on the U.S. territory of Guam. And earlier today, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson made his way back from a trip to Southeast Asia, and here's what he told reporters.
What the president is doing is sending a strong message to North Korea in language that Kim Jong-un would understand, because he doesn't seem to understand diplomatic language.
But Tillerson also urged calm, if not in Washington and Pyongyang, then in the rest of America.
I think Americans should sleep well at night. I have no concerns about this particular rhetoric of the last few days.
However, other members of the Trump administration today continued with the apocalyptic language. Defense Secretary James Mattis issued a written statement saying North Korea should, quote, cease any consideration of actions that would lead to the end of its regime and destruction of its people. So what's really going on here? I mean, is this a careful bit of calculated rhetoric, a return to brinkmanship in order to get North Korea to bend, or is it just reckless escalation? To help us sort through this, Kathy Moon. She's a professor of political science at Wellesley College and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and she joins us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so how do you characterize what we've been hearing from the Trump administration in the past couple of days? Is it, as Rex Tillerson has said, language that Kim Jong-un understands?
Well, to me, it sounds like two bullies duking it out through words. And in truth, when we're dealing with nuclear weapons and a very difficult state such as North Korea, we should not be taking the bully strategy. We should be having a much more, we the United States should be having a much clearer sense of what is possible as an ultimate goal. And frankly, denuclearization, which is the U.S. policy, the end goal in terms of dealing with North Korea, which has been consistent under Trump, Obama, Bush, and Clinton, this no longer works. Mm. It could have worked up until the last leader, Kim Jong-il, the father of the current leader, Kim Jong-un. However, this young guy leading North Korea will not denuclearize, period.
So before we get deeper into sort of what options are, what diplomatic options are on the Korean Peninsula, let me just ask you, when the president of the United States, and particularly this president, Donald Trump, says the kinds of things he says, I mean, I'm seeing reports now that other officials are saying that Trump's fire and fury remarks were off the cuff, really. And we have these other statements coming from other parts of the administration seeming to try to, like, temper the reaction. But regarding Trump himself and his statements, I mean, how much weight do they carry, or how much how do the North Koreans, how does Kim Jong-un hear those things?
Well, that's a very good question. And I think this is where the bully language is an appropriate framework to understand what's going on. Trump has the bully personality, and he's using this language to another bully, Mr. Kim of North Korea. The question is, does Kim take Trump seriously? And my answer would be not so much. Why? He's no different from any other leader around the world who has not been taking Mr. Trump seriously, because too much comes out of Mr. Trump's mouth and tweets that are confusing, contradictory, and they're actually very counterproductive for the U.S. government, the administration, his administration. My concern about this kind of this phrasing of fire and fury is not so much that it would escalate and make the North Koreans more explosive in their behavior, but that it really sends mixed signals to our own government.
Mm.
So, for example, the State Department, many people do not know this, but the State Department is very quietly, through back channels, has been pursuing efforts at diplomatic dialogue with North Korea. So North Korean diplomats and American diplomats actually have been trying for months to see if they can come up with an agreement to begin talks. When Mr. Trump says these kinds of things, it can really confuse the various parties. Is the U.S. government serious about productive, constructive, peaceful talks or not? And then also, what is the State Department supposed to do? Pursue
right.
this kind of an effort, which is actually sanctioned by the White House, or not? There's even some rumor that the Dennis Rodman visit of last month, right, the secret visit that was supposed to be private just on the part of Dennis Rodman. I've heard that people in Washington who, quote, are in the know think that that Dennis Rodman might have had the green light from Trump.
Huh.
So what is all this if he's talking one way and then action is another way?
So that's what's going on at the State Department. And I should note that we still have no nominee for ambassador to South
Absolutely.
Korea. We also don't have any nominee for the undersecretaries
and assistant secretary
for non-proliferation, for
right.
East Asian affairs. I mean, the State Department's kind of got a skeletal staff right now, for especially in these key positions. But over at the Defense Department, what position does this put someone like James Mattis in? Because if I remember correctly, he's consistently said that military action on the Korean Peninsula would be catastrophic.
See, this is what's curious, because Mattis was believed to be one of the very few people who knew what's going on and who is going to keep a level head on North Korea and every other security problem and help Mr. Trump understand what politics, international politics, is really about. So when Mr. Mattis starts changing his rhetoric or his words, I think it would make people nervous. On the other hand, he's got to hold on to his job. So I don't know if this is just basically kissing up to Mr. Trump or if he really has a policy change.
Right. Well, and in his statement, he also pointed out, this is Secretary Mattis saying that Kim Jong-un should take heed of the UN Security Council's unified voice, referring to that vote, that 15-0 vote on sanctions a couple of days ago. And then Mattis goes on to say that, and statements from government the world over who agree that North Korea poses a threat to global security and stability. So a nod there to diplomatic efforts and sanctions
well. Right. But I think the problem is that when Mr. Trump speaks this way, it is not just North Korea who is the audience. It's our allies and friends in the East Asia region, as well as other parts of the world. So Japan, South Korea, and China, how do they interpret Mr. Trump's words? These words, on the one hand, people find hard to take seriously because he has been changing his rhetoric, his public rhetoric about North Korea. He would be honored to meet Kim Jong-un, he once said. He would be happy to have a hamburger with Kim Jong-un, he said another time. On the other hand, he now says fire and fury, like the world has never seen. So these are very conflicting messages, and it does not help allies and friends figure out what our strategy is.
So China, a hugely important player in this puzzle,
right?
I mean, because on the one hand, perhaps the Chinese government sees North Korea as a buffer between it and U.S. influence vis-a-vis South Korea. On the other hand, China also is what? The main supplier of oil to North Korea, trade, food, etc. I mean, is it not in China's long-term best interest to have a denuclearized Korean peninsula?
Yes, it is in China's long-term best interest. But I think for China, there are several things that often get missed. It's not just about a buffer state. It's also that China has contractual treaty obligations to North Korea to defend North Korea. They are allies, and we often forget that. So they have to dance a very fine line between trying to work with the rest of the international community and with the United States and still acknowledging that they have a military alliance. They have an formal alliance with the DPRK. Number two is that China has said for the last 20 or so years since the George W. Bush administration that China is not the does not hold the key to North Korea.
They've said that.
They've said that.
But is that necessarily true?
Yes, I do believe that. And this is the one thing that I wish people would have taken more seriously, because China never wanted to be put in this position, never wanted to be the one who has to be this mediator. That's one thing. The other thing is, even if China were to squeeze North Korea so hard, the question is, would the North Korean regime kowtow to China or to the rest of the world and say, we give up? And my answer is no. And nobody talks about what will happen to North Korea. Why would North Korea succumb? Okay, if they're going to go hungry, they'll let their people go hungry.
That has happened before.
That has
yes.
happened before. If they have to use the most anachronistic sets of military armaments to prove whatever point they make, they will. It may not be nuclear, but they have conventional weapons that are antiquated, but they work. So North Korea is not a country, is not a state that is going to kowtow to China. North Korea actually looks down on China at times. And the third point, which a lot of people don't think about, is that Beijing, Xi Jinping, does not actually have full control over all of this humongous landmass called China, including the bureaucracy. He fights every day for control on over this territory. Northeast Asia, that is adjacent to North Korea, Northeast China, rather, that's adjacent to North Korea, has very thick economic ties that are not just about supply line to the north.
Right.
The Chinese in the Northeast benefit. So there is a regional economy there that has integrated North Korea into its everyday livelihood. And so for the Northeast Chinese to give up that integration, in a sense, that's what they're trying to fight against,
right,
in terms of Beijing.
So this detailed look at the Chinese perspective is absolutely fascinating to me. And I would love to have you back to talk about it more, because they are a major player in this challenge facing us. But before I let you go, I want to go back to something you said earlier, which is also extraordinarily important. I mean, you were saying that for the past many U.S. administrations, the end goal has been denuclearizing
right.
North Korea. And you said you don't think that is possible anymore. That is not a realistic end goal.
No.
If that is indeed the case, I mean, one could say the nuclear genie is out of the bottle in North
right.
Korea, then what are the United States' options? I mean, is it containment? Is it war? What is it? Because the threat is real.
Yes, the threat is real, and it's escalating, and I don't foresee any conflagration happening, but accidents can happen. Unintended violence can happen. What the U.S. faces is a problem between North Korean capabilities and intentions and an anachronistic, outdated U.S. policy strategy called denuclearization. The North doesn't want to talk as long as denuclearization is on the table and is the goal of the United States.
But then we have a stalemate, right? Because the United States won't say anything other
well,
than denuclearization.
Well, that's partly our problem. We need to, I think, really think hard and, in a way, face the reality and suck it up that this is a fully nuclear state. We treat North Korea and Washington, D.C. as a de facto nuclear state. We don't have to say, hey, welcome to the nuclear club, but we could work toward arms control and disarmament, which is a different framework, which acknowledges that it is a nuclear state, and actually try to get some diplomatic headway on that level, but also with economic goodies. We never spelled out to the North Koreans in any detail what kind of specific economic benefits would come to them if they were to open up to the world, and they don't have to denuclearize to do that. And that's what they want. They want to keep their nuclear program and to grow their economy. And they're doing both quite well.
Hmm. Well, that's a sobering reality check, Professor Moon, you're offering us. But I hazard to say that I don't think the political reality at the time
I agree with you.
is beneficial to that outcome.
And Congress is really the institution that would say no more than the White House or any other institution.
Hmm. Well, Kathy Moon is professor of political science at Wellesley College and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks so much.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.